Welcome to Accounting Marketing Doesn't Suck. Join host Hugh Duffy as he takes you behind the scenes with successful accountants, CPAs, and industry elites in conversations about growing a more profitable business. This podcast is meant to prove that accountant marketing truly does not suck, and in fact can provide you with new skills to improve your effectiveness so you can learn how to develop a business that you want to run, not a business that's running you.
Hello, and welcome to the Accounting Marketing Doesn't Suck podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Duffy. On today's show, we'll be talking to Jennifer Dominique. Jennifer is an attorney with Cannabis Legal Group, which is a leading law firm dedicated to the cannabis industry. With the emerging acceptance of cannabis on a state-by-state basis, I thought it might be helpful to gain some insights on the changing landscape from a law firm dedicated to the cannabis industry. Right now, cannabis is one of the most dynamic topics within the accounting industry and has been our best listened to podcast that we've done so far. In many ways, it's like the Wild Wild West. It is the fastest growing industry in the United States. And as of today, I believe there are 33 states that have legalized it. Before launching into the podcast, I'd like to share Jennifer's background and expertise. Jennifer graduated from the University of Michigan, then went on to law school at Washington and Lee in Virginia, kind of like going from the big house to the little house. Jennifer is an experienced litigator, representing cannabis clients throughout the state of Michigan, I presume at some point in time outside the state of Michigan as well. Jennifer's a host at Cannabis Business Live, which is a weekly broadcast on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, I'd encourage you to watch it. It's very interesting on Friday afternoons. Cannabis Business Live covers national news and local news related to the cannabis industry. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. So in your words, can you paint a picture for our listeners of what you're trying to accomplish with Cannabis Business Live, your weekly YouTube broadcast?
Well, Hugh, the cannabis industry seems to change on like a weekly basis. New laws are constantly coming down, new cases are being decided on, and the landscape changes all the time. So we're seeing a need for people to be able to obtain reliable information regarding the cannabis laws and how to get started with cannabis businesses in a compliant manner. So on our weekly show, we air it on Facebook Live, and then we also post it after the fact to YouTube. And we'll talk about licensing for cannabis businesses, how to set up your business safely, how to handle tax issues like the IRS code 280E that causes us a lot of headaches, and how to maintain regulatory compliance. We'll also cover just overviews of the law because there's a wealth of misinformation, and a lot of the laws that are being passed can seem contradictory or confusing to a lot of people. So it helps for individuals to have our team of attorneys read the law, digest it, and hear about it in a more relaxed space like Facebook Live or YouTube. We've done the legwork. We've reviewed the law, we understand it, and we're able to get people a more general and clear picture of what's going on. So they're able to ask questions and hopefully walk away with a better understanding of what cannabis looks like in today's society.
That's fabulous. As I understand it, there's some serious momentum on the banking front with the Safe Banking Act, which is federal legislation that would effectively allow banks and credit unions to accept revenue from the cannabis businesses. Can you explain how this would change things across the country?
Sure. So right now, across the country, there are hundreds of licensed and regulated businesses that don't have access to the banking industry because marijuana is a controlled substance under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. So any bank or credit union that is FDIC insured is unable to accept cannabis money or work with cannabis companies because although these cannabis businesses are completely legal and regulated in their state under state law, it still remains federally illegal. So they can't work with FDIC insured institutions. So what that means is that these companies can't do basic things like accept credit cards, deposit their daily revenues, write checks to meet payroll, or even pay taxes. This is the definition of a cash-only situation, and it's untenable, frankly. The way states are setting up cannabis companies is this is a highly regulated industry, and we're seeking to monitor these companies and protect the communities they're located in. However, no industry can operate safely or transparently or effectively without having access to banks or other financial institutions. We can't put these companies in a situation where they have to go out and find old banks to operate out of, because they already have a built-in safe, and that's ideal for working in a cash-only industry. I don't want to push my clients into old banks because that's the only option they have. I don't want to have to tell my clients that they have to, you know, build stronger walls because they might get run into with a car, because people know that this is a cash-only industry and we're, you know, an easy target. So it's not safe for my clients, my businesses, and it's not safe for the general population, the communities that these businesses are operating in. So right now, by having the Safe Banking Act, if it gets passed, it'll basically allow these companies to work with financial institutions, and it provides the financial institutions a safe harbor, meaning that the federal banking regulators can't go after them and try to penalize or sanction them for working with cannabis companies, even though marijuana is still federally illegal.
Interesting. So this legislation appears to have bipartisan support. Can you add some legs and arms to that?
Sure. So there's two bills. There's a House bill that's the main one for the Safe Banking Act. And right now, I believe as of today, it has 182 co-sponsors. So that includes 20 Republicans. This is the strongest piece of federal legislation the cannabis industry has ever seen from a co-sponsor and bipartisan standpoint. The fact that we have gotten co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle, and this number of co-sponsors says volumes. And I think that what is really compelling about this is just a public safety concern. We're just trying to eliminate the risks associated with operating on a cash-only basis. And so it's easier for people to agree on public safety than it is on just a straight legalized marijuana legislation bill. So as you said, marijuana is here already. It's legal for adult use. We call it adult use rather than recreational use in 10 states. And you said yourself that medical marijuana is legal in 33 states. So it's here. We just have to figure out a safer way to allow them to conduct businesses. So the House bill has 182 co-sponsors, and then the sister bill in the Senate, it's practically identical, but it's just the two bills working in tandem. And that has 20 co-sponsors, including, I believe, four Republicans. So again, we're seeing bipartisan support on both of these bills, and it's very strong.
And the state attorney general's offices, are they supporting it as well?
Yes. So there's a coalition of attorney general offices that have banded together to put pressure on the federal government to show support for passing this. I know that Michigan's attorney general, Dana Nessel, has joined this coalition, because this is a problem that's not just for the adult use states or the medical use states. This is a problem across the country. And the thing that we need to remember about this piece of legislation is this doesn't even affect the states that haven't legalized marijuana. So it doesn't hurt them to support this bill. All it does is protect the banking institutions from sanctions if they choose to provide banking services to state-licensed marijuana facilities.
I gotcha. So as I understand it, this legislation would solve a variety of issues, those being payroll processing, which you and I take for granted, but in the marijuana or cannabis business, it's not something that's taken for granted. Payroll processing, having a checking account, having a credit card to pay your bills electronically, as well as banks having to worry about losing their FDIC insurance. Are there other ripple effects that this legislation would start to all of a sudden move the ball forward with?
Yeah. So, for instance, paying taxes. Let's just start with something that's so basic, and we think of just, you know, you just have to pay your taxes. You just have to do it. Could you imagine taking duffel bags of cash to the state treasury office to pay your taxes and just dumping it on the yard because, you know, there's so many cannabis businesses that can't, you know, pay their taxes electronically or with a check. They have to take cash in duffel bags there. I mean, that is ridiculous. And so this would eliminate that concern. Also, it's going to basically bring our businesses into the 21st century. So we can operate with the safety of plastic rather than trying to find those locations with the reinforced walls and the built-in safes. So we're just trying to move this industry into a safer and more compliant landscape. And this legislation will have an impact not only on how the other industries and ancillary businesses can work with cannabis, but also how cannabis can work within the 21st century.
Okay. So are there some other transparent costs, such as, the cost of securing and transporting large amounts of cash? That would go down the cost of doing audits. Currently, a lot of government agencies are auditing businesses at will, randomly, and the business doesn't know anything about. Today, I open my doors whether or not there's going to be an audit. Is that something that would decrease now that you have a more transparent trail of what's going on with the business?
Theoretically, yes. So the thing about cannabis is the IRS right now is considering marijuana to be a special interest group. So they're auditing the companies far more regularly. So I always tell my clients it's not if they get audited, it's when they get audited. Because once you're state licensed, the IRS has a list of people who are operating in the space and it's easier to find them. So by having an audit, I mean, you'll know it's time consuming, it's frustrating, and a lot of it is putting together pieces of a puzzle because we don't have that paper trail that's associated with banks and bank accounts. By having the ability to put our cash at the end of the day into a safe bank account or a credit union account will save so much time and resources when we're doing these audits, and the IRS can look at it and the banks will have counted the money for us, so we don't have issues on how much we deposited or the dates on which we deposited. So it'll make things so much easier, not just for the companies, but also for the government.
Absolutely. So let's transition over to liability and risk, you know, which is the side of the equation that most of this audience, our listening audience, is concerned about, specifically CPA firms. let's talk about their liability and some of their risk. Hypothetically, if a CPA firm approached you, how would you recommend they structure the business to protect them from liability? Since liability is the thing that we all worry about as business owners, should they set it up as a separate entity, or would it be okay to operate it within the existing structure of their CPA firm?
All right. Well, let me just preface this by saying that I'm not providing legal advice right now, but generally, you'd obviously want your business entity to have some characteristic of limited liability, right? So we'd want to make sure that you're setting up your CPA firm to be a PC or PLC, anything that's going to give you that limited liability characteristic to protect you personally. Now, I've worked with several different CPAs who have operated within the existing structure of their CPA firm to provide cannabis services. One of my colleagues and good friends, Simon Guma, he provides CPA services to cannabis companies across the state under his existing CPA firm. And I spoke to him about the possible liability concerning his CPA services under his existing firm. And he agreed that there is liability. However, the American Association of CPAs and the Michigan Association of CPAs have both said that if a CPA wants to service the industry, they're not going to provide guidance necessarily, but they also are not going to impose penalties or sanctions. So that gives us some comfort that while we're not going to encourage you, we're certainly not going to punish you for providing a service to a state-licensed business entity. Now, if you wanted to separate your services out. You could certainly set up a DBA to operate and basically under the same corporate umbrella, but you can use the DBA to target the cannabis market a little bit more effectively. Also, it can act as a gap. I've had a couple of clients who have asked me to set up a DBA because their current client base is not comfortable with cannabis, and they don't want to work with a CPA or a lawyer or another professional who is engaged in and specifically marketing cannabis companies. And so if you're wanting to specialize in this field or really market your services, but you don't want to scare away your current client base, then set up that DBA, and then you'll have two names that you can operate under, but it's still under the same firm. So you'll be having the same insurance, you'll have the same bank accounts, really. You'll just have two separate names that you can market under.
And if they do set up a fictitious name, what are some of the common mistakes that you've seen?
So the biggest one, and probably the most important one, is you have to tell your insurance company that you're doing this. I have seen this before where, you know, if you don't tell your insurance company that you're engaging in these services, they're not going to know about it. And the problem with that is you need more insurance coverage. Your premium is going to go up. You'll have to deal with that as part of the services that you're providing. By providing attestation services to this industry, you're going to have a higher degree of liability. So the biggest piece of advice I can give is make sure you're upfront and honest with your insurance company that you've set up this DBA and you're going to dive into this industry, because they want you to have coverage and you want to be protected. So you have to make sure that you are explicitly clear with your insurance policyholder about what you're doing and what sort of coverage you're going to be needing.
So in many states, Michigan in particular, licensing aspect to get into the industry, to get into the business of providing cannabis medically or recreationally, often requires CPA attestation services for capital requirements that they're required to have to become a license holder. When a CPA firm attests to this, what kind of risk are they signing up for?
That's correct. So for Michigan, at least, when you are submitting a medical marijuana facility application, we're required to provide a CPA attestation saying that the applicant entity has X amount of capital and at least 25% of that has to be liquid. The amounts that you're attesting to vary based on what type of licenses that company is going for. So the risk that CPAs face are pretty serious. It's very similar to audits. So you're basically just verifying certain information, but that means that you're putting your name on a document stating that you're going to substantiate certain assets are there and that you have done your due diligence to confirm that the amounts are correct or that the value is correct. So just like an audit where you have a CPA verifying that the numbers are properly stated, a CPA attested statement or an attestation document is where you are saying that this company has the required capital needed to meet the eligibility requirements for the state. So you are effectively on the hook for the accuracy of your attestation. And if you're done improperly, then you could face fines or be sued, or you could be sanctioned or reprimanded by your associations. So there is some liability there. And you have to be cognizant of that. Also, your associations might not be providing that guidance, like I mentioned earlier, but the state regulators have recognized that these associations aren't necessarily providing a lot of help for CPAs looking to wade into this industry. So the state is actually giving out guidance on what they're looking for and how you can do this compliantly and not create too much of an issue. So if you wanted those resources, you could certainly reach out to the state regulatory agencies, and they have bulletins and general guidance for CPAs specifically on how to do this. but without a doubt, there's still going to be risk involved.
Okay. So let's shift over to the industrial hemp industry, which has gotten a lot of press recently. the press is interesting in that, you know, it's made national news, but as I understand it, the THC level is extremely low in the industrial hemp side. Is there a belief that hemp has medical benefits without THC?
Yeah, definitely. So when the Controlled Substances Act banned cannabis in 1970, it banned all forms of cannabis. Industrial hemp is actually a strain of cannabis. It's a form of cannabis, but it's not what we would call marijuana. It's similar, but it's still different. So industrial hemp, unlike marijuana, generally does not have any significant amount of THC. By definition, it's less than 0.3% THC. THC is tetrahydrocannabinol, or the compound that basically gives you that high feeling. So even though industrial hemp doesn't get you stoned or doesn't give you that high feeling, it was still lumped in with cannabis and outlawed as a Schedule I drug. So the 2018 Farm Bill that was passed last December differentiates hemp from marijuana and has effectively legalized it. Hemp benefits are widespread, not just for medical reasons, but you can make paper from it, hemp seeds, hemp oil, fuel for vehicles, and of course for CBD medicines or supplements. So there's a lot of different uses for industrial hemp, and we're very excited about that. But the main reason why people are really diving into this industry is to start producing CBD products. CBD is cannabidiol, and it's a property in hemp and in marijuana that doesn't give you that high feeling, but it does act as an anti-inflammatory compound. So there's been a lot of research that has been conducted, and it shows that it can help with various conditions like autoimmune diseases. So that would be like inflammation or arthritis, neurological conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Diabetes, skin disorders, gut disorders like Crohn's. There's all sorts of research showing that CBD has very real and tangible medical benefits. A lot of the research has been sponsored by other countries, and some of it's been sponsored by the U.S. government. We actually now have one FDA-approved medication for CBD called Epidiolex, and that's for seizures. So this is definitely a new beginning. It's a new frontier for these CBD medications, and a lot of CBD products can be derived from industrial hemp, and we don't have to worry about whether or not you have THC in it, because you can't have THC in industrial hemp. So you're not going to worry about getting stoned from industrial hemp-derived CBD.
And as I understand, most of it is for topical applications?
Yes. So right now, the federal government, the FDA, hasn't yet approved CBD as, we call it GRAS, generally regarded as safe. So that means that without FDA approval, these products are legal only if they're not ingested, they're not marketed as a dietary supplement or a food additive, or marketed to like cure a disease. So because the FDA hasn't cleared this one, you can provide CBD, but it can't be ingested. So topicals would certainly be an option for people if they're looking for some sort of anti-inflammatory relief. It's very common to see retailers all over selling these sorts of products. And right now, that's the way to get around the FDA until the FDA can actually clear CBD products.
Now, that you talked about retailers. You know, Walgreens, as I read, basically was rather aggressive coming out and actually going a little bit further. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So Walgreens, Sephora, CVS, a lot of major retailers right now are offering CBD products as part of their the products that they're selling for various reasons, for various types of – they market it differently. However, this is a way for these companies to put pressure on the FDA to start considering and regulating these items. And also it basically allows them to engage in the sale of these products, but to do so as compliantly as possible. So Walgreens was one of the first retailers to jump on the CBD bandwagon and say, we're going to start doing this, but I can pretty much guarantee that Walgreens attorneys had a conversation with the federal agencies and with other attorneys trying to figure out how they can do this as compliantly as possible. So they want to make sure that they're not breaking the law, but they're also making a very real move saying, listen, CBD is here. It's going to be legal. It's going to be reviewed by the FDA. So rather than ignore it, let's have a better conversation about it. And the FDA is not going to start coming in and banning it from all the shelves on Walgreens and CVS and Sephora and any health food store that offers it. So it's definitely putting pressure on the agency, and we're looking forward to seeing what the next move is from the agency.
Interesting. So let's move into the hypothetical space again. So assuming the Safe Banking Act is approved, say within a year, you know, because there's some fine-tuning it needs to go on. It gets tossed back and forth between Congress and the Senate. How do you see the landscape changing on a federal level with marijuana classified as Schedule I controlled substance?
So what the Safe Banking Act is doing right now is it's garnering support for the industry generally from both sides of the aisle. I think that this is just contributing to a greater dialogue regarding cannabis, and more dialogue is never a bad thing. Right now, I can't really speculate as to when we're going to see legalization, but I do believe that we will. I believe that we're probably going to see some major changes within the next 5 years. But right now, it is very encouraging that we're seeing both Republicans and Democrats work together to fix the problems that the cannabis industry faces. And by encouraging that dialogue and that bipartisan collaboration, we are inching our way closer to complete legalization across the country and really bringing this industry into its full potential.
Is there another logical hurdle that would come after the Safe Banking Act that would move us closer to this becoming a reality? Is there something logical you can think of, you've heard of?
Yes. So safe banking allows us to work with banks and create a safer environment for the local community and for the companies. There's an, without getting into too much detail, an IRS code 280E, which basically says that if you are engaged in the manufacture, distribution, retail of a controlled substance, then you cannot take any business deductions other than the cost of goods sold. And so right now, all of the cannabis businesses have to be very, very careful in how they're doing their taxes, because we can't take any of these normal deductions that any other business would face. So all of our taxes, or all of our income is going, quite a bit of our income is going to taxes right now. It's really making it difficult to lean into this industry with a profitable future. So if we could get safe banking first and then have a conversation about if you're a state licensed business entity, then why are we punishing those that are trying to maintain compliance under their applicable law by taxing them to such a point that it's difficult for them to operate legally? 280E is something that is the bane of our company's existence, and we look forward to changing that. But that's certainly a next step that seems reasonable and would make it that much closer to full legalization.
It's a good point that you've made on 280E. Is there another logical one that's been bantied around, considered, that makes sense on a federal level?
There's also been a discussion of, instead of doing a blanket legalization, just allowing the states to have their say. Right now, we have to sign attestations with our companies saying we understand that this is in violation of federal law. And our clients don't necessarily want to sign that. So by descheduling cannabis and taking it off of the Controlled Substances Act and allowing the states to regulate it for themselves, if they choose to, then we can have a situation where you're not violating federal law anymore. And it's a state's rights issue rather than having this structure where it's legal under state law and illegal under federal law, and then everybody ends up confused. So by descheduling it, then we'll be allowed to have interstate commerce and generally just move forward with a blanket deschedulization and hopefully a stronger economy moving forward.
Jennifer, that was great. I really appreciate it. I got one last question with regard to Cannabis Legal Group. If somebody is outside of the state of Michigan, do you guys work with people outside of the state of Michigan?
Absolutely. So in Michigan, our state is accepting applications for cannabis businesses that are based outside of the state, so you don't have to be a Michigan resident. We work with companies and individuals all over the country that are looking to start their companies inside the state of Michigan. And we're also affiliated with our partner law firm, Vicente Cederberg, based out of Colorado. So we'll service through them all sorts of companies across the country in their licensing and cannabis business needs.
That's fabulous. I didn't realize that. So to learn more about Cannabis Legal Group, I would encourage you to visit their website, which is cannabislegalgroup.com. I would also encourage you to watch their Facebook Live and their Cannabis Business Live on YouTube as well. It's on Friday afternoons and it airs once a week. They have nearly 100 episodes at this point in time. Jennifer, thanks again. I really enjoyed it. I thought there was a lot of insight that you shared here, and it looks like a big opportunity going forward as we move into the modern world.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Counting Marketing Doesn't Suck. If you liked this episode, you'll also want to listen to episode 12, where Hugh interviews the co-founders of Dope CFO, a cannabis practice development firm, and they talk about all the issues plaguing the industry, why it's not too late to jump into the niche, and the risks involved for CPAs. They're smaller than you might think. Make sure to subscribe to the Accounting Marketing Doesn't Suck podcast so you don't miss any future episodes, and consider leaving us a review to let us know how we're doing. The Accounting Marketing Doesn't Suck podcast is produced by Build Your Firm, providers of marketing and web design exclusively for accountants.